5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
You make $5 million a year. I'm a jerk on the radio, I know better.
Those are facts. Print that. Tweet that.
I don't like people or teams or products that dodge the heavy lifting.
If you don't like what we say or anybody says, here's what I would suggest. Get a rating.
The idea that you preface your opinion by what your identity is to me insane.
You gotta be kidding me. You can't run this clown out of town fast enough.
This man is a disgrace. He's throwing everything away. Get him the hell out.
That is a take. It's a strong take. It's one of the best takes ever.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. Now, here's your host, Jason Barrett.
We are up to episode number 8 of season 3 of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I am Jason Barrett. It's great to have you here. Today's guest needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He's a guy I spent 4 years with in the Bay Area, one of my favorite people in the business, the great John Lund, who does afternoons on KNBR in San Francisco alongside Tom Tolbert, will be here. You know, when it comes to Lund, if sports radio gave out a championship trophy to its biggest nomad, he'd be in the conversation along with Kevin Graham and Greg Henson, although those guys now have a heavier hand in news talk. So by default, Lund probably takes the title. John has worked in Salt Lake, Portland, Detroit, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and he's originally from Southern California. As big of a mutt as you're going to find in our business, but with each of those experiences comes a lot of life lessons, and so John's going to get into some of those as we go through the course of our conversation. Additionally, you didn't think I'd go through an episode without plugging the Barrett Sports Media Programming Summit, did you? I mean, listen, I would stop as soon as you guys buy all the tickets and fill up the room, because when you've invested a pretty good chunk of money to make it happen, you need asses in seats. So guys, step up your game and help me out. It's going to be a great 2-day event. February 21st, 22nd in Los Angeles at the Grammy Museum. Got a bunch of great speakers that are going to be announced as we get closer to the date. Jeff Smullyan, the CEO of Emmis and the founder of WFAN, essentially the guy who started sports radio. We've named an award in his honor. He'll be there. Got some other great details coming forward soon. But again, tickets are on sale. Hotel rooms are discounted. Speaking and sponsorship opportunities are available. For more information, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. Okay, sales mode is over. Time to bring you a conversation. I really enjoyed conducting this one with John Lund of KNBR in San Francisco, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it as well.
3, 2, 1.
All right, Mr. Lund, you've been in the Bay now 7 years, but before you got there, you had traveled the country. You've been in Pittsburgh, Detroit, Dallas, Portland, Salt Lake. Obviously, the Southeast, they feel like they've been rejected because you never showed up there.
Yeah, they don't like me.
Before the radio journey began, though, where were you and who did you watch or listen to before you got started in this career?
It's an industry, as we all know, that certainly at first, like you graduate college and you think, I'm done eating macaroni and cheese and Top Ramen. And actually, if you're going to be in this business, it just started all over again. You hit the reset button and you started eating Top Ramen again. But I didn't want to bite the bullet. I was actually writing, and then my dad had a company. To me, it was extremely boring, which was like selling French fries and doing all this stuff. So I wanted to make money, so I did it just briefly. And then I came to him one day and I said, I can't do this. So I went and bit the bullet again. I started working with David Locke, actually, in Salt Lake City. He's the play-by-play voice now of Utah Jazz. He gave me an opportunity to produce, which led into a hosting opportunity. And then, like you said, then I traversed the country, basically like a motorhome that has all those stickers all over it of everywhere they've been. So that's kind of what happened. And I don't know if that's a dying breed. I don't know if I would do that all again, you know, going all over it. But it's kind of given me a perspective of kind of every different fan base. And I've kind of maybe taken that and melded it into everything. And then in terms of who I patterned myself after, I mean, I think everybody of a certain age, that early ESPN radio stuff, certainly Jim Rome was everybody's kind of early influence when I was coming through, those kind of guys. But, you know, I learned from some local guys too. that you just have to be yourself. You're on the air so much that you can't be something that you're not. And certainly in today's, as this kind of thing has evolved, and I think I started hosting in like 98, and I think I started just, you know, being in the business in like 96. I think that David Locke got the rights to the Utah Jazz. None of us knew what we were doing. And we basically, Kevin Graham was there. Actually, there were a lot of really talented guys. Graham's actually not talented, but there's a lot of talented guys. Ryan Hatch was there who has done a great job in Phoenix. So, yep. You know, we had a really good group of guys that have gone on. Then Ian Furness, who's in Seattle, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of guys who have had a lot of success in the business. And we didn't know what we were doing, and it was really fun. You know, everybody has probably been on a station that had that camaraderie. When we started at the game in San Francisco, we all were from different parts of the country, and we wanted to topple KMBR, and we had this attitude, and we were kind of rebels. And yep. you know, it happens a few times throughout your career where you really have a philosophy, and it's in lockstep, and the egos aren't developed, and everybody's having fun, and you really like each other. And then you're at other stations where you try to fake that, and you know it's hard to do. But we had that in San Francisco. We certainly had it in Salt Lake City, and so that's where a lot of the influence came from.
You said something interesting there about, you know, learning other fan bases. Yeah. One of the things that you gain perspective the more you travel is you learn that what works in New York doesn't work in St. Louis. Because you've told me before, you know, Detroit wasn't as smooth for you as San Francisco has been. So from a host standpoint, you know, for people who are thinking about embarking on the career or they're trying to advance today, what advice would you pass along based on your experiences of how to work and operate in a new market when you're not from there?
You have to integrate yourself into the community off the air. So in other words, whatever everyone has done, okay, even if it's dorky and even if it's tourists only do it, you have to do it. Like when you come to San Francisco, if you were a host, you got to go to Alcatraz. You got to go do different things. You got to do everything that everyone's done. And you really got to use your time to integrate yourself into that community off the air. Find everything out you can. Read all the dumb tourist books and understand. Like when you come to San Francisco, you can't call it SF.
Right.
You can't call it San Fran. You can't. That is a woo, woo, woo. You're not from here. Like,
right.
You can't make those mistakes. And when you do, that fan base who has lived there their whole life and lived and died with these teams, they just automatically scratch you off the board. I mean, they're looking. It's almost like any kind of relationship that you have. When you first start dating someone, and believe me, this is not my area of expertise, as you well know, you're looking for the flaws, right, in that person. Not so much what you love, but what you – can I live with this? You know, can this person snoring or whatever it is? Well, it's the same thing with listeners, with hosts. It's like, what is the thing – that I can't stand about this guy that won't have me listen. And look, we all know the old Howard Stern philosophy is if you don't like him, you listen more. That there is some of that, but there's also other things that are an annoyance or that something you may not know. I'll give you a great example. In Detroit, I was there and I'm doing a morning show and this song comes on, the final countdown from Europe. And the first thing out of my mouth is, this song sucks. Why are we playing this? Why are we playing this for our bumper music? It's terrible. And my host is across me going, no, no, like, you know, waving his arms. No, no, no. Well, I later find out that was the championship music that they played for the Detroit Pistons when they won championships. And everyone loves that song. Like, it's the greatest thing ever. And I'm just killing it, right? I'm crushing it. Well, you know, some people never forgive you for stuff like that. And it's just, that's what you learn. Like, I know we have a hard time as talk show hosts doing this, but listen, learn, understand the market. What are important things? This is another thing. And like you said, Detroit probably wasn't my finest hour. One day I came back, Aretha Franklin just recently died, and I said Aretha Franklin was overrated in Detroit. That was brilliant. you know, that wasn't received so well. I mean, you have to understand it. Look, it's a learning experience, but you have to integrate yourself into that market, not only off the air, on the air, understand before you speak. Who am I talking to here? You know, who are the legendary people? Crook and Kuiper, broadcasters. That if you want out of San Francisco, rip those guys. You want out of San Francisco, rip Willie Mays. You know, those kind of things. I mean, there are just certain icons that you have to understand in that market. I went to Pittsburgh, and Myron Cope, the late Myron Cope, they love him in Pittsburgh. If you're an outsider in Pittsburgh, you wouldn't understand him. He talked, you know, hey, the Steelers are giggly, giggly. You're like, who is this guy, man? Is he drunk? What's going on?
Yep.
But he's an icon, so you can't make fun of Myron Cope. I guess if you're Mark Madden, you could. But he was already established. I wasn't.
Right.
So you've got to understand, you know, those kind of things. And here's, and lastly, your favorite teams are the local teams. Like if I'm in, here in San Francisco, I'm not a Dodgers fan, even if I was. You know, I'm not a Bears fan. I'm not a the local teams are the teams. People don't care that you grew up whatever of a fan you were. It's just your personal bias of who you loved as a kid. You know, they want to hear about their local team. So you have to integrate yourself as a local both on and off the air, and people will accept you. And something that you did after the ill-fated Wheelhouse that I really appreciate that you did for me, that you brought in – when you brought in Greg Papa, for those who don't know, he's a local legend. He's been calling – you know, he's calling Warriors games when he was 22 years old. And, you know, Raiders, A's, he's called it all. He's been fired from it all, but he's called it all. And so he's the best. But, you know, I realized that when you put me with him, it was a great benefit because I just shut my mouth and kind of rode the coattails for a while until I could get my own credibility. Had I gone out and just been a loudmouth, blabbermouth to try to prove to everyone how much I knew, that wouldn't have worked out so well. But all of a sudden, you know, after a number of years, I gained credibility through Greg and people accepted me. So, I mean, it's a big deal because like you said, if early on in your process, like was really the case in Detroit for me, if you put your foot in your mouth, these fans are passionate and they don't forget.
You talked about essentially sacrificing your own ego and your own shot to make sure mm-hmm. that Greg got his. And at that time, if you remember, Greg was doing 2 days a week. You were on there 5 days a week. So yeah. You had more of a hold on the show. Obviously, Greg was a big personality. Him coming in there 5 days a week, it was important to get him going. And when you're a host, you know, there are some guys that, and I've always used the equation, there's Steve Nash and Allen Iverson. Steve Nash gets points, but he's looking to make sure he gets others involved. Allen's shooting, and everyone's standing on the three-point line waiting for a rebound. And you were willing to sacrifice to get others involved. That doesn't always work that way, especially with drivers. Why do you think that's so important for a show to be successful?
Look, we all have egos here, and we all want our opinion to be heard, and I think we forget on the air that it's for the greater good of the whole. And so as you get older in this business and more mature, you understand, much like in life, that everybody's going to get theirs. It is like a sports philosophy, and I go into a show thinking to myself, what's best for the show? And if I get 2 minutes to talk, if I get no minutes to talk, I mean, we used to, as you well know, you developed this, and it was a great concept, though I'm loath to give you credit, but you did a great job here, which is we had the baseball hour, the football hour, the basketball hour, in which we brought, you know, we had me, we had Greg, we had Bill Romanowski and Rod Woodson. So, I mean, you're talking about guys who really know what they're talking about. And if I interject in there just to have my voice be heard because my ego can't shut up for 2 or 3 minutes for the good of the show while Rod Woodson, a Hall of Famer, is breaking down some great stuff, if you can't in your mind see, as, you know, you've got to be a listener sometimes and go, man, this stuff is great. I got to lay back.
Right.
You know, Greg is a great storyteller. And when he's on a roll on some stories and stuff that he probably actually shouldn't be saying, I'm not going to interrupt him when he's telling like he's probably as close as you could have gotten to Al Davis. And so he's telling a great anecdote about Al Davis, or Bill Romanowski's talking about spitting on J.J. Stokes, or, you know, Rod Woodson's talking about playing in the Super Bowl, you know, whatever. He's one of the 50 greatest players of all time. If my ego can't take a back seat to realize what great radio is, then, like you said, I'm not doing my job. And my job in that show was, and look, I'm not patting myself on the back, but Greg was at home on an ISDN line. Romo is Romo. He's wacky and wild and crazy. And then me and Rod would kind of try to keep things together. But I'm just trying to push the show. In other words, we talk about this all the time, a freeway, get off the freeway, get back on. Look, these guys would take this thing into the desert. I mean, we were way off-road sometimes, and then it was my job to just pull it back.
Hell, there were times it almost led to fights.
Oh, yeah. But during a break one time, you know this, Rod was so good at this. He was almost like a big brother.
Right.
And he would antagonize you, and it was just like, and Romo just lost it one time, and Rod was... Because Romo, what had happened was Romo had basically taken a shot at defensive backs. In other words, you guys don't hit. Well, it pushed a button in Rod, and they kind of start going back and forth. And Rod just kept saying to Romo, you got the wrong guy, man. You got the wrong guy. In other words, Rod did hit guys.
Right.
And it just infuriated Romo. And they were getting eye to eye. And you know, a lot of times we had to have the dumb button ready for Romo because he would just use colorful language because he would forget he was on the air. And basically they almost came to blows and we had to break it up during a break. But it, you know what it showed, as you well know, and that's what made the hour so great, was it just showed a lot of passion. They were right into what they were talking about. And again, I'm not going to interrupt that. I'm there to keep things on track occasionally, have a sense like a quarterback in the pocket of, okay, 3-2-1, let's get this thing back. I don't want to pull it back when it's great or has the potential to be great or even explode like that did or something. That's not my job. My job is to pull it back when I feel the need. A lot of times in that situation with four guys in there and one sitting at home that likes to talk, to let this thing breathe and let it go. It's like a play-by-play guy. These guys have such great senses of the moment. And so they don't over-talk a moment. They let the moment be. When you see a great home run or walk-off or a touchdown, whatever it is, these guys let it breathe. Well, that's what you got to do on the radio. You got to let the thing breathe. You got to put your ego in the back seat. And you got to realize, not just day to day, but segment to segment, moment to moment, what's the best thing for the show. And once you realize that, you'll get your accolades.
Well, you talked about, you know, the role difference there and being willing to sacrifice ego. I want to talk to you about how that relates to talent and program director, because you've worked for a number of talented PDs. You joked about Graham earlier. You've worked with Scott Masteller, Jim Gracie, Jeremiah, myself.
Yeah.
What do you think, from a talent standpoint, what separates a good PD from a bad PD, in your opinion?
First and foremost, honesty. Look, if you don't like something, tell me. If you do like something, tell me. You know where I learned this the most was I was in Dallas and I was programming for ESPN, and I was working with Deion Sanders and a bunch of the former Cowboys, Michael Irvin, but it was more Deion Sanders. And he had done a show for us, and it was really, really good. And then he comes into my office. He was with him and Irvin and Nate Newton and all these guys. And they sat down in my office, and they said, how was the show? And I went, it was great. Because most talents, like, I'm the greatest. I'm going home. You know, 1 minute before I walk in, 1 minute after I'm leaving, and that was the greatest show ever. These guys, and especially in Deion's case, I mean, this guy's a Hall of Famer. He knows what he's doing. He sits down and says, okay, I want to be coached. I want to know, you know, what I can do better. What is it? Those guys are used to being coached. So it's the same thing with radio talent. You know, I want to be coached. I want to get better. I want to know what I'm doing right and what I'm doing wrong. Now, there's a wrong and a right way to approach it, I think. During the show, unless it's an absolute emergency, which I think I remember you once or twice going in there.
I had one day where I just chewed you and Papa to shreds. It's the only time I ever lost my shit with you guys. And I was like, listen, all right, when we have a comedian in the studio dropping racial bombs, I'm going to come in.
Oh, yeah. that was terrible.
Greg was on the ISDN. I'm telling Mitch Moss, get it out now. Get it out now. And literally, the guy keeps talking, and Greg's asking other questions, and I'm going.
Greg loved the chaotic, you know what I mean? He wanted it. And I couldn't, I was like, I remember you and I went at it in a break or something, and it was like, yeah, that was maybe the only one. But I understand that. I totally get that. I remember one time I was in Portland, and we were doing a radiothon or something. It was 24 hours, and this was probably a bad idea. The guy was doing the show with Kenny Vance and I, we'd like to hang out late night. He put us on the midnight to 3 a.m. shift, and we, you know, predictably went out and had a few drinks, and then we jump on, and you know, we're getting a little racy, and literally Scott Masteller in a robe from his house, put on slippers and a robe and drove down to the station and went, get out. Just get off, get out, you know. So, I mean, I get it. Like, those things, the comedian that you came in for, the Masteller, I'm trying to think if there was any other times. I'm sure there was plenty, but we used to go off on the rails all the time. But the reality of it is, more times than not, you got to wait, because all of us are ego, creative. You know, it'll throw us off.
Right.
Or, you know, like if you come in the middle, unless it's an absolute emergency, then I don't care what personality it is, it's going to throw you off. I mean, when I was programming, Mark Madden might have been the most volatile guy that I ever worked with. And if you went in the middle of Mark's show, then not only would Mark do the opposite of what you said, he would start like ripping sponsors, because he knew that was, you know, basically the lifeblood. So if our big sponsor was Coors Light, he would say how great Bud Light was and how Coors Light sucked. And then you're dealing with the sales side. It was so, you know, certain guys, it's not going to do any good. But my point in going back in a roundabout way to your question is, the number one thing to me is honesty. You know, I can't fix anything if you're not telling me what's going on. Or if you're telling me something's great, I'm going to keep doing it. Or, you know, so I think honesty is the thing. I think that knowing what the philosophy and direction of the radio station is, it's not a democracy when you're a programmer. You don't have to get approval from everybody, but getting the buy-in, especially from your top talent, I think is critical to trying to push what you're trying to accomplish. What is our direction? What is our goal? What are we trying to do? What kind of a station are we? You know, ESPN is far different than what the Ticket in Dallas is, or what, you know, it just depends on, you know, what am I trying to accomplish? Again, when you hire somebody, you kind of know what they are. And going back to the philosophy you're just talking about, look, you are who you are on the air. You can vary it. Like, I do pre and post games. I've done those for years in my career, and versus a regular talk show, which is a far different animal. So I can adjust, but you hired me to be, you know, somebody that I am, and that's generally who I am. And so I'll give you credit. You did a great job with just a monthly meeting. You made it fun. If any of us in this business wanted to be in meetings, we'd be in corporate America.
Right.
We hate meetings. Everyone hates meetings, but I think the creative guys hate meetings. We start twitching and freaking out and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, but you do have to do it on occasion.
Right.
Look, don't hide ratings. Like, if we're great, great. If we're not doing great, tell us, and let's sit down and let's – I don't understand stations where I've been in the past where it's like there's some cryptic thing where you're not telling me the whole story. Look, I'm a big boy. Tell me what's going on financially on the station. Tell us what's going on philosophically. Tell us what's going on from a rating standpoint. You know, look, if you don't like the show, that's fine, you know, whatever. But I it just goes back to me that you'll respect people that are honest with you.
When you're starting a station, especially the first 2 years, I think it's really vital to get everybody, hey, here's where we are, here's where we're going, here's what I need you to do, here's some things to look at that you need to be conscious of, because you're trying to build a culture where people understand what's at stake. As you go
That's
along, then you go to the point where, okay, maybe we don't need to do this every month, maybe it's every 3 months, you know, maybe we're just doing show meetings. But you've also been in buildings where there is none of that. And then you sit there and you go, all right, well, we all do our thing, but there's no, like, togetherness. There's no fun going on between shows. And to me, I just think – and look, some will say, why do you need to do that and get 30 people in a room? You're right, you don't. I mean, you can win different ways. You've seen it through the eyes of a PD before because you've been in that position. What do you consider the biggest challenge to programming a radio station?
You have to establish who and what you are and what your philosophies are early. You can't wait. And so when you're intimidated by some of the talent that has been around that's on that station, you know, look, I'm on KNBR right now. Murph and Mac have had a great run at it. I work with Tom Tolbert every day. He's at 20-plus years. Gary Radnich has been around forever. And look, you could either have a philosophy of these guys are really successful, I'll just leave them alone. You could have a philosophy that, you know, you're going to let your ego – you know, I'm going to play a hard court. You have, again, to use kind of a sports comparison, you got to treat everybody differently. And I'm not treating, you know, Tom Tolbert the same way that I'm treating me. I mean, it's just the way that it goes. So, but you have to establish those relationships early. You have to, and especially for key guys. Like, again, when I was in Dallas, Randy Galloway was the key guy that I needed to establish my rapport with. When I was in Pittsburgh, my key rapport had to be with Mark Madden. And again, it didn't disrespect any of the other guys in the station, but I felt like right when I got in there, I had to establish a strong relationship with those guys. And I felt, as you did, I had to have meanings to this is philosophically what I'm trying to accomplish. I have always had a philosophy, whether it was on the air or as a PD, that while I'll play within the parameters of what I have to do, whether it's as a GM, as my boss, or somebody like you who is a programmer, I wanted to play within those parameters, but I had to keep my own style. I called it, if I'm going down, I'm going down my way.
I was going to ask you, though, how do you adjust, though, when maybe you have a market manager who loves that style, but maybe he doesn't? How do you adapt to that?
Look, through GMs, we all know this. They don't care about anything but the bottom line, especially today. So how is it going to benefit them financially? If you walk into a GM and you're going to talk anything but how I can make you money, whether it be through ratings, because then you can charge more, or whether it just be through straight revenue, you're not speaking their language. And so, you know, that was something that I had to go through certainly early in my career. I didn't see eye to eye in Dallas with Pete Ditz. Pete's a good guy, but I'd be lying straight through my teeth if I said that we worked well together. I mean, it's just, we philosophically, I was a frontline guy. I wanted to get my hands on the radio side because that's what I knew. And he was more of a, you know, I want you to be my right-hand man in business meetings and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that's where I had a decision to make, like you said. And my career has kind of been unique in that way, in that, you know, I was at a fork in the road, maybe even later than most, and said, okay, am I going to go down this road and be a programmer? Am I going to go down this road and be an air talent? And because there was so much of the business side on the ESPN, which you well know, there's just so much of that that it takes you away from radio, which was my passion.
You know, I want to talk to you about another challenge that you've went through in multiple markets, because you've worked on the side where you're working for a radio station and they encourage you to be candid, speak your mind about the local teams. But you've also been on the side where you're working for a radio station where they have a relationship with the team and they tell you, hey, be very respectful of our partners. What's important, in your opinion, for a talent to understand in each of those situations?
It's a complicated question because there's a few different things at play, and then I'll answer the question. Number one, as an air talent, how much of my back will my program director have? Are you on a pregame show, postgame show, or are you doing a talk show? It also depends on what sponsors are involved in that, who the player is, all those, you know, what the market is. In Detroit, you could rip and roar. I mean, look, we carried the Lions the year they went 0-16. What was I going to do? Go on the air and say, these guys are great. Yeah, you know, they'll absolutely bury you because that's the market. Detroit wanted truth. Now, again, we all know this, but I've been all over the country and experienced it firsthand. What you say or what is accepted in New York, Philly, Detroit, Chicago is far different than what is in the West Coast. If you sit here in San Francisco and you tear on the Giants day after day after day after day, they get sick of it. They just get sick of it.
Right.
It's not what they want to hear. Now, they don't want smoke blown up their ass either, but you have to find a happy medium. In other markets, in Detroit, we actually got better numbers when the team was worse. It's the weirdest, but it's just that's how it worked. The Lions sucked. Our numbers went up. When the teams out west here stink, our numbers do not go up. When the Giants are great, the numbers go through the roof, and we all go, oh, we're so good. And then, you know, when they're not as good, they're not as, you know, it's pretty simple. Same with the Warriors out here, the Warriors. And, you know, basketball is not as much of a sport like baseball like that, but, you know, around playoff time or whatever, they start to spike. So I've always had the philosophy of, if I keep it on the field, then I have no problems. In other words, if my opinion is, you know, this guy stunk because, you know, here are the numbers. I was in Detroit. Joey Harrington went into Green Bay and went like 4 for 21 for 82 yards, you know. I mean, he stunk. And then after the game, he went, oh, I think we're getting really close. It was like, what are you talking about? You know, so if I keep it between the lines, I'm fine. If I start taking personal shots at a guy that my program director or company can't defend, then I'm going to find myself in trouble. I mean, that's a basic philosophy. Keep it between the lines. The other key to me was that I showed up in the locker room occasionally. You know, you do that less when you're in a larger market because you have reporters and everything else. But I made sure that if I said something about somebody, that I was in the locker room that week. If they wanted to talk to me, that was fine. I was, you know, culpable for what I said. Whatever I said, I was, you know, that's kind of what I felt. So if you can defend it, if you understand time and place, if you understand your market, if your PD will have your back or not, you know, there's a lot of different things that you have to take into consideration to determine how hard you go at a player, how hard you go at a team, how consistently you do it. Because like I said, if I sit here and rip on all the local teams day after day after day in San Francisco, that's not going to work. If I do it in a different market, like I was in Detroit and the Lions are 0-16 and I'm cracking them every day, the ratings go up.
I'm going to wrap with some quick hits here in a moment, but I want to get your opinion on something as it relates to the business side of our industry.
Sure.
Because a lot's changed. You know, you mentioned earlier you've been in it since essentially 96, 98. During that time, mm-hmm. we've seen text and tweets become more active than calls. We've seen updates become less of a factor. Another side mm-hmm. that's drastically changed has been the way some stations take care of their talent when it comes to endorsements and appearance money. There's been some more battles for a lot of personalities when you're going through a contractual process. Looking mm-hmm. at that last part, what should a talent expect and be doing to make sure they're in strong shape with a company when it comes to reaping the rewards of endorsements and appearances?
The way that I've always looked at it is it depends on if what's important to you. I mean, some people don't want to do a lot of it. Gary Radnich, I think at KNBR, has done one in his entire career. We're talking 30 years at KNBR. And then there's guys like me and Larry Kruger and Tom Tolbert, and we'll whore ourselves out for, you know, pennies on the dollar. Well, Tom won't, but me and Larry will. But you know what it is, for those who are newer to the business, I know I'm going to age myself here and I hate to do this, but when 9/11 hit and sports went from, you know, on TV with your local anchors who to me have become vastly irrelevant, sports went from like, you know, 3 minutes to maybe 90 seconds or 60 seconds, and it became more difficult. You know, we're talking like in the 2007 when everything was crashing, it, you know, became more difficult and advertisers wanted more for less. And what are you going to do for me? And I don't just want a regular spot. I want, you know, this and I want that. You got to understand that you can have the philosophy, which we used to have in this business, which is I'm going to produce great content. You're going to sell it. End of story. And I can be arrogant and I can be a jerk and too bad. I'm getting the ratings. You deal with the sales side. It doesn't work that way anymore. I go to event after event to talk to clients, to interact with clients, because you have to realize that while, and I'm not taking a shot at sales guys, but actually I am, they're going to go in, they're going to try to sell you. But the reality is if you show up at an event, if you shake a hand of a client, sports radio is and always has been a passion buy. So we get great ratings at KNBR. I feel lucky to be on the station because it's a heritage station that's been around forever. The brand sells itself like an ESPN or something along those lines. So it's a little bit easier. But I don't care if it's KNBR. I don't care if it's a brand new startup. You've got to embrace sales. You've got to make yourself easy to work with for that sales guy. Look, the other day, I didn't want to do a spec spot. I do a million of those things, and it's like, ah, what a pain. But the reality is it takes 60 seconds. You know, if you need a spec spot, fine. If you need to occasionally show up at something, fine. We did. Look, I'm not a huge fantasy football guy. We had a thing on Wednesday night where we had some clients, and you shake hands, you kiss babies. And look, it's actually fun once you get up there and you meet these clients. And who knows? You may meet a guy. It was Tolbert's client. But, you know, you may get a spinoff, and they like you, and then you're going to make a few bucks. Like, these are basic business principles that people not in our business deal with every single day. It's relationship based. You got to realize it's a bottom line business. Your ratings may slip one day. And guess what? If you've got, and I've experienced this, when you're in a contract negotiation, if you have six or eight clients who say, if Lund leaves, I'm leaving. And I've had that happen before where I had a bunch of clients and I was in a contract negotiation and they wouldn't budge. And I finally had to pull out the big card and I said, look, I know for a fact these clients will go with me. So you're paying me X. It's real simple. They're paying a hell of a lot more than what my salary is. And I understand, having done this, what the percentage is in terms of what they want to get back for every dollar that they spend and everything like that. So I understand that formula. But you have to make it easy. You have to be sales friendly now. You always should be. But look, you don't have to do all that much. It's not that big of a pain to put on a smile, to meet with clients. We are in a business. And it is going to survive or fail based on dollars and cents.
There are some guys who literally, the extent of what they want to do for a client is read the script. And I'm like, look,
right,
man, does
not,
it
doesn't work.
Like, if you go out one time every 6 months to this guy's restaurant, you just interact with the owner and the guy feels like,
yeah,
hey, we got a relationship here, like, that goes a long way in people re-upping. It isn't even about the ratings at that point.
Yeah.
It's about who's speaking for them and the connection they have.
Yep. Like I said, sports is a passion buy, not just in sports. It doesn't make any sense for these companies to buy a $1 million box at a 49ers game. But they do it because, yeah, they can get business out of it or anything, but there's an ego involved in it. You know, that's just what it is. Sports is about passion. And for a lot of stations, it doesn't make sense to buy, you know, X amount of dollars on a station that is a male demographic. For some it does, some it doesn't. Depends on the market. But again, it isn't that hard to, like you said, well, all my reads now have turned into, over the years, they want them to be personality driven. They want them to be weaved within the fabric of the show. They don't want me to just read some script, blah, 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 blah. They want to give me bullet points and they say, go crazy, be who you are. And that's what I do. And so, you know, those are the kind of things that keep clients. It doesn't take that much more time to do. And look, like I said, we're going to survive or fail based on the bottom line. Look, you can get all the ratings you want, but if you can't monetize those ratings, you're done. Conversely, you can have low ratings, and if you monetize those ratings and people love you and they're spending money, you're going to thrive. You're going to survive. You're going to make a ton of money.
I'm going to wrap with you on something I call quick hits. I'm going to hit you with four questions, just the first thought that pops to mind, okay?
Oh, boy.
The thing you enjoy most about doing a talk show with Tom Tolbert is what?
We laugh a lot. We have fun.
The best and worst market to be a sports radio host in is which?
San Francisco is the best, man. We're on the West Coast, and it's pretty much good weather every day. We got a bunch of teams. I would say San Francisco, my personal choice. The worst, oh boy, man, you're putting me on the spot. My worst was Detroit. I just didn't fit. Look, I like to have fun and laugh, and they want to get angry and yell and scream. And for me personally, it just, it did, I wasn't a fit.
Once you started killing Europe, the band, you knew it was all over.
Aretha Franklin, Europe, the band.
Number three, and this is something I know that you put a lot of stock in. The one thing a producer needs to be strong at to win a talent's trust is what?
You cannot be afraid. You got to believe. You got to get it across. And whatever your philosophies are, whatever you think about a guest, because look, we're going to challenge you. Why the hell did you put that guy on? What are you talking about? Why are you doing this bit? Stand behind your convictions. Be strong. Yep, we're all a bunch of egotistical guys. And at times, I'm not talking about me. I mean, you know me. I'm not intimidating at all. But certain guys can be, you know, Tom Tolbert's 6'8", 260 pounds. You got to tell him, look, you got to break. We're putting this guy on. You got to read this. Sometimes your job sucks and you're not getting paid the most money, but you got to look at yourself and say, look, this is my job and I got to get in these guys' face if they need to break. I need to convince these guys to have this guest on. I need to, you know, whatever the case may be, you're having a bad show. Let's go snap out of it. Look, you got to have balls, man.
The final one, and I know you're going to appreciate the creativity in this question. More, more enjoyable, executing a segment called the Caboose Pistol, or finalizing a divorce?
Oh, man. Look, that's a close one. Finalizing a divorce is a pretty great thing. Although I've come to, as you well know, I've come to realize that while it's nice to be on the open market, it's not as nice to be on the open market when you look like me. But then secondly, that's just, the fun is just beginning. I love that payment every month to her. It's just great. So you ask me which is, I'm saying Caboose Pistol because every day, I mean, that was a great segment. For those who don't know, we just kind of did wacky stuff at the end of the show, but and everybody kind of does that. But just given Greg's personality and kind of where we would go, and you can push things pretty far in this town. We used to get off the. It was pretty much a guaranteed off the rails segment every single day, and it's just, you know, you love that, man. You love to be able to laugh and smile and end the show like that because you always had a great feeling. And it's almost like golf, you know, you hit a great shot.
Right.
And you want to come back the next day. I mean, we always left thinking we hit a great shot. Let's come back the next day. And a lot of times that last segment, and I don't mean to go on a tangent here at the end, but that last segment can be a throwaway. You know what I mean? Where you're
yep.
like, what the hell do we do with this last segment? And I never felt that. We always looked forward to that segment. We always knew we were going to have fun. So it kept up the energy of the entire show because we knew we never had throwaways. And at the end, we never threw that segment away, and it was really cool. One quick thing, because I know you got to go, but on a serious note, the most difficult moment I ever had in sports radio, he helped me through, because I got a call about 10 minutes before a show one time, and my dad used to never – he would never bug me before a show. And he told me he had pancreatic cancer, which, for those who don't know, is an absolute death sentence. And I said, oh, we're going to fight this. We're going to fight this. It's like 10 before noon. We're going noon to 3. And he goes, it's not going to work. I'm done. I got 90 days, and I couldn't believe it. And so I, you know, because I was really close with him. He was like a rock in my life. And
right.
I walked in, and I bawled my eyes out for about 5 minutes. And then I said, all right, show's got to go on. And I don't say that for sympathy or anything, because I had a great relationship with him. He's a great guy and was a great guy and everything else. But the point I make in that is you got to have a trust with your programmer, and we built a really good trust. It was a lot of fun. And the other point of that, saying that, is people don't care about your day. When you're in that box, you got to focus. That's the only thing you got to do. And really, when I was going through my divorce, I think it really saved me to go in there every day for 3 hours and focus on stuff. When that situation happened, it actually was therapeutic to go in there and focus. And, you know, just no matter what your day is, no matter what your you know, is going on in your life. And look, a lot of us are dumpster fires. I mean, we just are. We're great in those hours that we're on the air. But you know as well as anybody, we're a complete mess away from it. Just have fun, man. Go in there every day with the philosophy to have fun, kick ass, focus on what you got to do. Look, I remember lots of times where when I was especially through my divorce or something, I would bawl during breaks, man. And then it was like, okay, lights on, let's go. I mean, that's what you got to do, man. You got to focus. You got to be great. And you got to, you know, you just got to concentrate on your craft and realize that we're really fortunate to be doing what we're doing.
You said something interesting, though, and it's a good way to end is, you know, when you were going through the situation with your dad and you talked about, you know, going through a divorce and, you could come in the office and talk to me and shut the door, and you knew you'd have somebody who had your back in those situations.
Yep.
And I'm very intense at what I do. I'm always thinking about the result. How are we going to succeed? What do I have to do today to beat the competition? And so you do get tunnel vision in what you're doing professionally, but equally as important is, while you're chasing results, is having relationships and connections with the people who are battling with you, and that you're there for them and able to have those real conversations and show you're supportive as a boss when they're faced with things like that. Because if the only time you can reach somebody is when you're talking about how to get a better rating or how to make a few dollars more for the radio station, you're not going to have that personal relationship that is ultimately why they're going through a wall for you.
It comes down to, like you said, relationships, trusting people that you're working with, being honest, you know, all these different things. But, you know, again, I felt like I could walk into your office and be honest with you when something wasn't going right. You and I had some battles. That's definitely something that is normal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can both put your egos in the back seat. There are some people who can't. But look, like I said, it's a great business. It's fun. I've met so many damn good people and talented people in this business. It's really been a really, really cool ride.
I enjoyed the time we spent together. Good seeing you last month while I was out in the Bay. And you've had seven years of success in San Francisco. It's one of the best markets in the country you can work. And you've held up your end of the bargain by doing a damn good job. So keep it going, man. And try to keep my guy Jeremiah a little light, because you know he can get pretty tight there.
Yeah, no doubt. Will do. Thanks, man.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.